This is Kristen Yount reporting for KABU. On Friday, November 8th, I spoke with citizen Bob Rossi upon his return from a month-long visit to Turkey and northern Kurdistan. Last summer, citizens in Istanbul protested the decision by the city government to develop a city park. In October, Amnesty International published a report accusing the Turkish government of grave mistakes when it came to dealing with protesters. The report says that 8,000 people were injured and at least a few fatalities occurred. Authorities employed the use of 100 armored trucks and deployed 100,000 canisters of tear gas. Critics blame the Gezi protest and massive backlash on the part of the authorities as a lack of democratic policy. The war in Syria puts a strain on Turkey in a few ways. First, the country is inundated with 600,000 refugees. Also, the federal Turkish government started to build walls on Turkey's Syrian border, interrupting the daily interactions between Syrians and Turks. But it also divides the community of Kurds. Protests on both sides of the wall are met with harsh violence from the Turkish army. In Nusaybin, the mayor, Ayşe Gökhan, ended a 9-day hunger strike this past weekend. She started the hunger strike to protest the so-called Wall of Shame being built by the Turkish army. Gökhan belongs to the nationally recognized Peace and Democracy Party, or BPD. The BPD is a pro-Kurdish rights organization. Bob Rossi is a labor organizer here in Oregon. Rossi wanted to see firsthand how the Turks and the Kurds were working together, not just to strengthen labor policy in the region, but really to resolve human rights issues relating to race, gender, economics, and class. The two groups share alliances on the local levels of government, but struggle to find a balance on the national level. As the national government lashes out violently at dissent, the movement to forward human rights grows in direct opposition. Turkey will have elections this spring. Leftist groups are trying to get a foothold to oppose what is seen as an imperialist and authoritarian government. And now, the interview. So, what was it that made you decide to go to, of all places, Turkey and North Kurdistan?
Well, since last spring, the freedom movement in Turkey has really picked up. And I wanted to be in solidarity with that movement and with the labor movement in Turkey and in North Kurdistan as well. And I've long been inspired by the struggle in Kurdistan.
What particularly about the struggle in Kurdistan draws you as a labor organizer?
Well, the struggle in Kurdistan and North Kurdistan, I should say, and Turkey is really in an advanced state. There's a intersection of class, race, or national and gender questions. I think that the movements there are really leading the way internationally. And I wanted to learn from those, and I wanted to be of assistance as well. It was my third trip to Turkey and my first trip to North Kurdistan. This time I went into Ankara, which has become the center of the student movement since the Gezi Park protests in Istanbul last spring, and then I went to Diyarbakir in North Kurdistan as well. Diyarbakir is the unofficial capital, I guess, of North Kurdistan and the center of much of the activism there.
The protest over the park, things sort of, I think, for the most part, in our media outlets, things sort of trailed off after things settled down there as far as media goes. Can you remind us of how that whole conflict ended?
Well, I don't think it did end. I think you're right. I think you hit a very fundamental point that the media stopped paying attention, but the movement continued to progress. The Gezi Park protests in Istanbul sparked nationwide protests. Incredible police repression was the response or the answer. In Ankara, there is the Middle Eastern Technical University, ODTU. It has a huge green space, and the plan is now to build a 4 or 6 lane highway through there and put some official government building there as well. And students and community people have been protesting this since the summer at least, and the protests have escalated, as has the police repression there. So the movement hasn't stopped at all. There are also neighborhood assemblies in Ankara that talk very seriously about questions of community power. And there is a Kurdish community there of about 100,000 people that's active in the Peace and Democracy Party, the BDP. While I was there in Ankara, the BDP allied with another left-wing party and formed a unitary organization that will be a challenge to the establishment, not just in Ankara, but in other parts of Turkey as well in the upcoming elections.
So you talked about how imperialism is coming up against this authoritarian government. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, we hear something in the United States about the so-called Turkish model. Turkey has had very high economic growth with the reactionary government that is in power there. But at the same time, Turkish society itself has become more divided economically, and the gap between the cities and the rural areas economically has grown quite a bit as well. Turkey is an imperialist country in regards to the Kurds and in regards to the situation in Syria, but it's also used by American imperialism as a kind of watchdog or police force in the Mideast. And that's a lot for the conservative government in power in Turkey to handle, and they don't do a very good job of that at all. Their instinct is, or their recourse is to go to the most authoritarian solutions first, I think.
So instead of putting proper policy in place, they're just this knee-jerk reaction to anything that happens with the people protesting. Is that what you mean?
Yes, in part. The economic policy of the government has just really been a disaster in the long term for Turkey as well. And you see how debate in government gets subverted this week and the last couple of days. The Turkish parliament was supposed to debate the economic policy and the budget of the government. And instead, the ruling party has turned this into a debate about male and female students living together in dorms, completely backburnering any meaningful discussion on the country's budget and economy.
Yeah, dodging the bullet altogether.
Exactly.
So, were you able to determine if there were tangible land use laws? Is it okay for the Turkish government to come in and just decide this is going to happen without citizen input? I know that the Roma in Istanbul have always been sort of trying to fend off the government from demolishing their housing. With the needs of, you know, the apparent needs of Turkey to grow their infrastructure and put in these highways and develop these green spaces, is there any real recourse for Turks?
Well, I think I'm glad you brought up the situation of Roma in Istanbul, because that's a case in point where developers in Istanbul really got to call the shots, and we saw an entire neighborhood area destroyed and redeveloped. Not for the people that live there, who have been dispersed to Istanbul, but for developers and tourism. Where the universities are concerned and where Gezi Park is concerned, different laws apply, and I'm not an expert in Turkish real estate land use laws, but I would mention that laws have had to change in order to accommodate the government's repression. This week, a law was passed that said that students could no longer carry or display protest signs in universities, for instance. So a real backstep politically for people's power and control over land and resources. I would also say that the Peace and Democracy Party, the left of center Kurdish party, has made land use and ecology really top of their program issues in Turkey and in Kurdistan.
So elections are coming up in the spring. Mm-hmm. What are the scope of those elections? Is it, nobody really in this country, I think, understands what the election cycle is like. Do you know what the election cycle is like and what positions are going to be voted on in the spring?
Well, we'll see a new federal government. I think the AKP, the governing party, will win the national elections. I think they will have a harder time holding on to seats in parliament because the Peace and Democracy Party and the other left party join forces and create a real opposition. And there will be elections at the municipal level and what we would call counties, I suppose, level. And I think we'll see some real gains for the left in those races. And I think we'll see some gains for the center, the Republican People's Party, or CHP. I think we'll pick up some seats as well. But I think the governing party, the reactionary party, has reason to be confident that they'll win the national elections.
How many, if any, public offices do Kurds hold in Turkey proper?
I'm sorry, I don't know. And I don't know if anyone knows that, actually. I've never seen that tracked in any Turkish or Kurdish site. I've never heard discussion about that. Southeastern Turkey is pretty united behind the BDP, the Peace and Democracy Party, which, as I say, is a left party of Kurdistan.
There are cities and possibly counties in Turkey that are sympathetic to mm-hmm. the BPD and want to see more involvement with that. Can you comment on that?
Well, I think you go into places like Diyarbakir, which are BDP run, and although those places are really poor, they're also incredibly active, and they form kernels of resistance to the national agenda as well. And I think it also needs to be said that many people who represent BDP in parliament and locally are also in prison or facing prison. In some cases, parliamentary immunity has been taken from them. And I think you can judge BDP's great progress by the repression directed against it at the national level and at the local level as well.
Can you give me a direct example of members of the party who have been persecuted?
Leyla Zana is the person who people in the West will be most familiar with. She is currently in parliament. She has been tried and convicted in court. Her parliamentary immunity was lifted. She was previously imprisoned in Turkey for speaking Kurdish in parliament, taking her oath of office in Kurdish, I believe, and wearing Kurdish national colors in parliament. Amnesty International led an international campaign on her behalf and got her out. But she's, again, in trouble, and there are many of her fellow deputies as well in parliament who are facing the same or similar charges this time around.
The backstory about people disappearing and being punished for essentially being Kurdish is something that's been going on for a long time. Can you tell us about some of the things that you actually witnessed?
Ankara is very different than Diyarbakir. Ankara is the country's capital and looks a lot and feels a lot like Western Europe. However, the protests there, led by the students, as I said, are met with incredibly violent repression. I witnessed that myself. I took part in demonstrations that were repressed by the police. In Diyarbakir, you get the feeling immediately that you're in an occupied area, in an occupied city, by the presence of the army and the police force. But you also see in the people's faces there a strong determination to move forward, particularly among women. It needs to be said that BDP has a 40% rule, that 40% of their candidates will be women, and their leadership is 50-50, men and women. And this springs directly from aspects of Kurdish life. Kurdish women experience or enjoy a higher degree of equality in society than Turkish women do. And that's apparent, readily apparent among people. I also got to meet with the leadership of KESK, which is a very progressive trade union of public workers in Diyarbakir, and was very impressed by their militancy and their fight for Kurdish rights as well as the rights of workers.
How does that look when you say, is it like the United States where you see people picketing, or is it more an internal process where when they decide that there's going to be a labor union, can you kind of describe what that looks like?
First of all, only 8 or 9% of people in Turkey are in unions, and I would say that the number of people organized actually is much less than that, because some of those unions are sellout unions or religious unions or reactionary unions, not real unions. It needs to be said that KESK has led part of the Kurdish freedom movement by insisting that Kurdish be taught in the schools, in all schools, and insisting on the national rights of Kurdish people. And they paid a great price for that. In the KESK Union Hall in Diyarbakir, there is a long corridor of photographs of their members and leaders who have been disappeared by the military and by the paramilitary since the late 1980s. There are currently scores of KESK members in prison, and also many people coming out and going in for their involvement in the Kurdish freedom movement. They're able to take these things, these issues, into the work sites, but they're also able to take them into the community as well and organize around them.
So organizing not just in the workplace, but on a policy level within
that's
the schools and...
That's right.
So... To say that you're, you know, organizing for a union, it really does touch all these other aspects of life.
Exactly. There are two progressive or radical trade union federations in Turkey. KESK is one, DISK, the Confederation of Revolutionary Trade Unions, is the other. They both have taken strong stands on social justice and have taken that. It's come from their membership and resonates through both organizations.
What aspects of what you learned on your trip can you use in organizing here?
Well, I think, again, for me, what was driven home was the need for international solidarity. KESK represents public service government workers, the same as the union I work for does. We have many things in common, and we have many things that are different, but there's a lot that provides a lot of room for conversation and some basis for joint work. Also, the left in Turkey is much larger than the left in the United States, has a broader reach, and probably more variation. Of groups and tendencies, there is a growing cooperation between left groups there, brought on by the protests from Gezi last spring and the protests in Ankara now. People are learning to work together in new ways, and confront the power and build their own people's power as well. The other thing is that BDP, the Peace and Democracy Party, really has done great work on the environment and on feminism, and has changed the Turkish Kurdish landscape quite a bit. The demands right now in the Kurdish freedom movement are, first of all, that the constitutional and legal safeguarding of Kurds' existence, identity, and culture needs to be put in place. Second, there needs to be acceptance of the Kurds' existence as a society and their own administration. And third, the acceptance of the mother tongue at every level of education. And the realization is that this can't move forward without a democratic constitution in Turkey, without a great change in Turkish society and in the political environment. So that's all things that we can be in solidarity with here. And there is a takeaway for us here about how we unite the movement in the workplaces with the movements around the environment and feminism and popular power.
So just a holistic approach to improving citizens' rights in general, the rights of ethnic minorities, the rights of women, protecting those in on a policy level.
Exactly. The Kurds aren't demanding a separate state. They're demanding something much more radical. They're demanding a federal system that unites them with Turks, but unites them across Kurdistan as well. A voluntary federalist system, if you will, that's strong at the base, or strongest at the base.
Do you want to comment on relations between the ruling Kurds and the leaders, the Kurdish leaders, and their relationship with Syria?
Well, it's a very complicated situation, and it's been more complicated in the last couple of weeks, as you know, by the Turkish government attempting to build two walls through Kurdish communities, separating Kurds in Syria from Kurds in Turkey. And the resistance to these walls has been strong and somewhat successful, I think. The PKK, the armed wing of the Kurdish freedom movement in Turkey, began to withdraw its forces to Iraq earlier this year. Some of those people have gone into Syria in solidarity with brother and sister Kurds, but the Kurdish struggle in Syria is led by Kurds from there. It needs to be said that women are particularly prominent in the fighting in Syria and have won tremendous military victories there. On the other hand, there are something like 600,000 Syrian refugees in Turkey. Many of them have gone to Diyarbakir, where I was. These people have no resources. Hundreds or thousands of them are begging on the streets. Many of them seem to be slowly starving to death. So the situation needs to get solved in the right way soon.
So you personally witnessed Syrian refugees nearly starving on the streets?
Yes. Yes, people living under miserable conditions on the streets in Diyarbakir who were Syrian refugees, yes.
And are there no relief agencies in play there, no NGOs? Or?
There are camps. In other areas, I'm not aware of resources there in Diyarbakir for Syrian refugees. The city was poor before these folks arrived. They walked into a bad situation, and it's only getting worse. It's tragic. The only bright spots are the victories won by the Kurdish armed forces on the ground in Syria. And Assad in Syria has, in effect, created or given some autonomy to the Kurds while they fight the Islamist forces there. The Turkish government has been supporting Al-Qaeda and its affiliates or kindred organizations. Today's news says that the Turkish government will no longer do that. I don't know if I believe that or not. But that's really the source of this dislocation and tragedy, I think.
Well, to say that the Turkish government has been colluding with Al-Qaeda is a pretty strong statement. What makes you say that?
Well, I don't think anyone doubts that. There's an article in Hurriyet today, which is a centrist news source, saying that the Turkish government will no longer do that, which says or implies that they've done it in the past. Fratnews.com has been given has been giving extensive coverage to this for some time. Those are sources I would both trust.
So I will both of those sites on our website so that people can peruse them. They're in English, mm-hmm. and leftists or even anybody in the United States can check out what's happening in northern Kurdistan, in Turkey, and use your mind to establish some parallels between their struggle and our struggle at home. Do you think that you'll be returning to the area soon?
I hope so. I was invited back for a Union Congress in February. I hope to do that. We also hope to bring over some people from Kesk in the future as well.
That's the end of the interview between myself and Bob Rossi. Bob Rossi is a labor organizer here in Oregon. He wanted to see how the Turks and Kurds are working together to strengthen labor and human policy in the region of Turkey and Kurdistan. Thanks for listening. This is Kristen Yount for KBOO.
With your KBOO Noon News headlines, I'm Jimmy Tardy. Ahead of a union vote to approve an 8-year contract extension by Boeing Machinists Union members, Washington Governor Jay Inslee has signed a package of tax incentives favorable to Boeing. Inslee stated that the incentives would secure tens of thousands of jobs in the state for years to come. The bill solidifies Boeing's tax status until the year 2040 and is worth approximately $9 billion. Machinist union members are expected to vote on the contract extension on Wednesday. A reporter for the Miami Herald has been released by Venezuela after being held for 3 days. Jim Weiss was in Venezuela covering chronic shortages of consumer goods and upcoming local elections. The release comes as Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro ordered army troops to occupy a chain of electronics stores. Claiming that the stores were overcharging customers, Maduro stated, quote, "We're doing this for the good of the nation. I've ordered the immediate occupation of this chain to offer its products to the people at fair prices. This robbery of the people has to stop." The occupation is reminiscent of similar actions taken by Maduro's predecessor and mentor, Hugo Chavez. Maduro, who accuses rich businessmen and right-wing political foes backed by Washington of waging an economic war against him, said the occupation was simply the, quote, "tip of the iceberg in a nationwide drive against speculators." "The ones who have looted Venezuela are you, bourgeois parasites," Maduro said, accusing electronics chain DACA of raising some prices beyond 1,000% of cost. Following unprecedented and surprising declines in its prison population, the country of Sweden is closing 4 prisons and a detention center. The 6% drop in prisoner numbers over the past year is attributed to Sweden's strong investment in rehabilitation and relapse prevention, combined with a new practice of more lenient sentencing for drug offenses and other minor crimes. The opposition Syrian National Coalition has announced